attorney, advocate, author, public speaker. The Lisa Wexler Show. WICC 600. Flip that switch and turn on your brain. Here is Lisa Wexler.
And welcome back. It's a few minutes after 11 o'clock at 203-333-9422. Call me at 203-333-9422. Well, it is a Friday, and I do love a Friday, and I love finding good news for you on a Friday, but I'm searching and searching. You know what the good news is? The good news is I'm going to go see my folks. I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to go see Mommy and Daddy, and I'm so blessed and lucky to have my Mommy and Daddy still alive and well and fabulous. You know, yesterday I had I have a good friend named Jane, and she came by to visit me in my afternoon job. And she just came by, and we were just chatting. And she showed me a will of her grandmother from 1966. Her grandmother passed in the 90s. And it's an old document. I was looking it over. And she was saying how her mother, who's still alive and well, but her mother kept things with original signatures. And I have a check that my father wrote for my birthday many years ago that I never cashed, simply because I love the pleasure of looking at the check with his signature. I just like it. It's on my desk. I didn't want to cash the check. If I cash the check, I don't have the check anymore. And I wanted my dad's signature on the check. And I think that many times we have a sentimental attachment to things that are real, that remind us of people that we love. My mother has an address book. She doesn't use an iPhone. It's an old-fashioned address book, and it's got a lot of crossouts and erases and new addresses. And that address book, which is stuffed full of extra pages and, you know, and things that are written on the back of other pages and changed phone numbers and changed addresses. It's a real-life historical log of the people that have been in and out of her life. And I love the address book because it's in my mother's handwriting. And I think sometimes about the digital world that we are living in, our present. You know, when we make our videos, we who are in our 50s and above, when we make the videos of our kids' bar mitzvah and wedding albums, we still have some actual photos to look at. And some of them, going way back a couple of generations, have this curled edge, this white curled edge around, like a scalloped edge around the photo, if you know what I mean. I have a picture of my dad peeling potatoes in the National Guard, skinny and handsome and black and white, smiling into the photo, and it's one of these old black and whites with scalloped edges. And there's something so real about this. There's something so real about the feel and the touch of someone's handwriting, of a photograph that was actually developed versus something that sits on your iPhone until, oops, you know, your iPhone ends up in a lake or in the toilet and you lose it. And oh my goodness, I've had that happen too. And we take, you know, 5 or 10 photos. Sometimes they even call it a burst by accident of a moment in time. And then how often do we end up even developing it? And I've just been thinking about that. You know, one of the pleasures I have, I'm a probate judge in the afternoons. And we have these very, very old wills because Connecticut's an old state in my district. And they are still physically located in the vault, which is attached to my office. And every now and then, if I'm in a mood, a historical, sentimental mood, I will just go in and look at people's handwriting before the age of typewriters, when people wrote wills out in longhand, and the penmanship, the handwriting was so exquisite. It was so exquisitely beautiful. It was a work of art. And that's the way people communicated, and they took their time and they had thoughts. You know, and we live in a world now that everything is just whizzing by us. Time is accelerating. It's accelerating. And it does that anyway. You know, they've shown the human brain. They have a phrase called the longest, shortest time, which refers to childhood, which is true. The longest, shortest time, if we think about it. How things, how summer camps, how memories that are from our life from when we were a child seem etched in our memory as having happened over a longer period of time than they actually did. And then as we get older, time does accelerate. As we get older, it crunches a little bit. But I think about the tangible aspects of human beings and my mother's address book and my father's signature on a birthday check. And I keep these artifacts, even though my parents are alive and well and hopefully will remain alive and well forever, because they are very tangible reminders of my parents, and I love them very much. So I'm winging my way down right after this. I'm winging my way. I am going to Westchester Airport. I'm flying on JetBlue, which I love. And I will be landing in Boca Loca, West Palm, sometime this afternoon. But I will be back behind the mic for you on Monday. 203-333-9422 is our number. 203-333-9422. Call me at 203-333-9422. It's 11 minutes after 11 o'clock in the 11th month of the year. It is November. Today was a cold morning, but I didn't mind it because it was sunny. All right, some other news stories we haven't discussed yet. Michael Bloomberg. Who would have thought? Well, a lot of people. But Michael Bloomberg apparently not wanting to miss a deadline to get on the ballot in Alabama. Alabama is not a particularly hot spot for the primaries. But if you really survey, the entire 50 states and you're seriously thinking about wanting to run for president, you want to make sure that you're on the ballot in every single state. And apparently the deadline to get on the ballot in Alabama is coming up quickly. So quietly, without making too much of a fuss, Michael Bloomberg is petitioning to get on that ballot because he obviously wants to keep his options open to be called in as a nominee for the Democratic slate. Now, what happens is by now, we're getting closer and closer to Iowa. February is New Hampshire. And so by now, these candidates who've been plugging away day after day, month after month, hiring and firing in their own campaigns. Kamala Harris last week fired a bunch of people. Pete Buttigieg keeps hiring. I mean, there's an up and down and an ebb and flow here. Within the Democratic Party, they're going to resent a quote-unquote latecomer like Michael Bloomberg. But it wasn't so long ago that wanting to weigh in over a year before an election wasn't that early in a campaign. We've gotten used to endless campaigns. We've gotten used to endless candidacies. We've gotten used to presidents who, on the day after they're sworn in, are having rallies to be reelected in 4 years. That's not the way it used to be. And by the way, it's not normal, and it isn't even a new normal. What's far more normal and typical is someone like Michael Bloomberg, a little bit more than a year away from an election, saying, you know what? Maybe I'd like to run. But what do you think of the prospects of a short, billionaire, rich, Jewish man from New York getting elected in America? And I say that with all due respect as another member of the same tribe. I don't think his prospects are very good. I think Michael Bloomberg is brilliant. I think he was an excellent mayor by and large in New York City, although not 100% great. I don't love the way he rezoned Midtown. Not happy about it. And the after effects we're seeing all the time. But by and large, he knows about competent, excellent government. And he's nobody's fool, and he's incorruptible because he has so much money, even as compared to President Trump. Money has to be, at this point, relatively meaningless to him. No, nobody could buy him off one way or another. It's a ridiculous comment. He's worth, they say, over $50 billion. Some amount of money that's not fathomable to most of us. But he brings with him a history of having run New York City for 12 years without a scandal, without a problem, without even much of a tax hike, and making it an extremely livable, walkable, pedestrian-friendly, more so. He planted about 2 to 3 million trees within the five boroughs of New York City when he was mayor. And he's not a denier of climate science, far from it. He comes from a fiscally responsible background. He's nobody's socialist, that's for sure. Michael Bloomberg is not in the Elizabeth Warren faction of the Democratic Party. He's not going to be progressive to the point of laying eggs on Israel. as opposed to Bernie Sanders, another Jew who's running, who wants to make Israel much more accountable for its internal political decisions than has ever before been demanded of a Democratic candidate for national office. So what do you think? You think Michael Bloomberg is a credible addition to the race? Is he somebody that you would support, Democrat or Republican? 203-333-9422 on the Lisa Wexler Show, 16 minutes after the hour. 203-333-9422. And welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show, 18 minutes after the hour. 203-333-9422. Jennifer Doulos is still missing, but the lawsuits go on. A Hartford Superior Court judge has decided that he will not require criminal defense attorney Norm Pattis to turn over information on how he is being paid. This in the context of a $2.5 million civil lawsuit against Fotis Doulos. Attorney Richard Weinstein, who represents Gloria Farber, had asked the judge to reconsider his own decision, in which he initially denied Gloria Farber access to information on how her son-in-law was paying for his defense team. And remember, he is still technically her son-in-law, because although divorce proceedings were pending, they were never finalized, and she has disappeared. She has disappeared, but she has disappeared under a cloud of extreme suspicion that she met with foul play. It is 19 minutes after 11, 203-333-9422. It's a Friday. It's a Friday, and the snow that was maybe supposed to happen didn't. And it's getting colder, but it's supposed to. It is November after all, but I'm going to be winging my way to 80 degrees. And I'm going to be putting on sweatpants and taking a walk. So I'm happy. I'll be back Sunday night. I'm going to see my folks. 203-333-9422. There's a rapper named T.I. Christian, you ever heard of this guy? Rapper T.I.? Me neither. Just because I haven't heard of a rapper really means nothing. But I saw this. This is wild. This is wild. Listen to this. There was a podcast that debuted, and this rapper was interviewed on the podcast. And he was asked about, I don't even know how the subject came up, but these podcast ladies called Ladies Like Us, they were asking him about whether he had the sex talk with his children. He's 39 years old. And he said, he's only 39 years old. He said, yes, not only did he have the sex talk with his kids, but he makes yearly trips to the gynecologist with his now 18-year-old daughter. Can I just say, whether I was 15, 16, 17, or 18, the last place I'm going to a gynecologist with who I'm allowing to accompany me to the gynecologist is my father. Thank you very much. That's what mothers are for. But then this is why he got in trouble. He said he went to the gynecologist every year with his daughter to make sure her hymen is still intact. Could you imagine this? That's what he talked about on a podcast. Later, the ladies apologized. There was a lot of backlash. It was the podcast was removed from Apple. But that's what he said. We have yearly trips to the gynecologist to check her hymen. And obviously that got a lot of backlash because not just of the word, but a lot of feminist organizations said, quote, I don't know, but who needs to hear this, but virginity is a made up social construct and it has absolutely nothing to do with your hymen. Many other activities besides sex can stretch your hymen, like riding a bike or doing sports. So ouch, ouch, and double ouch. 203-333-9422. At 11:22, we've got You Be the Judge coming up at 11:30. In the meantime, next week begin the impeachment proceedings. And let me just give you the latest. According to a transcript released yesterday of an impeachment inquiry interview with career State Department official George Kent, Kent testified that, quote, POTUS, meaning President Donald Trump, wanted nothing less than President Zelensky to go to the microphone and say investigations Biden and Clinton. Basically, there needed to be, this in his words, Kent testified, three words in the message, and that was the shorthand. Kent told investigators that was his understanding of what President Trump wanted Ukraine President Vladimir Zelensky to say in order to unlock U.S. military aid. Numerous current and former Trump officials, according to the Associated Press, have testified that the president was conditioning that aid on Ukraine, publicly investigating Democrats, including his potential 2020 political foe, Joe Biden, and Biden's son, Hunter Biden. Ken also raised concerns about Giuliani's, quote, campaign of lies against Ukraine Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch and the Trump's administration, then firing of Marie Yovanovitch. We'll probably hear from her next week as well. House investigators are releasing key transcripts from days of closed-door interviews in the impeachment inquiry as they prepare for us to hear these public sessions next week. And the whistleblower's identity, President Trump has been toying with the idea of, actually it was Donald Trump Jr., I think, who was toying with the idea of disclosing the whistleblower's identity, which would be completely uncalled for. The idea of being a whistleblower is to protect one's own identity. And frankly, the identity of the whistleblower at this point is irrelevant because everything the whistleblower said has been verified in testimony by many other career State Department officials who are willing to put their reputation, their jobs, and their careers on the line in sworn testimony. Let's remember what these State Department officials have on the line, right? If they think, if they're lying or they're somehow couching the truth in a way most favorable to themselves or couching it in an agenda, they have everything on the line. They obviously they could be found to perjure themselves if they are doing so. They have their careers on the line. President Trump has thought nothing of firing people with whom he disagrees and letting them hang out to dry and having attorneys having to represent them when they are on the defense end of all kinds of accusations. I mean, this is where really the rubber meets the road in terms of people who are lifetime employees of the federal government who believe they have a mission. This is where many of them, or at least some of them, are looking at their own internal conscience. It is their moment of reckoning. Now, I know that there are people who view these testimonies as full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. I'm hearing that. I get it. I know some of you are calling into the show to say that. And believe me, I'm out on the street talking with people and understanding what people are thinking and saying. But when I scrub it all, in my mind, it's just one person's opinion, my mind, I see career professionals who day in and day out have faithfully served administrations as diverse as George W. Bush and Barack Obama. And we've never heard from these men or women. We've never heard from them. They've never once said, as much as they may have personally disagreed with George W. Bush's incursion into Iraq and how disastrous that was for State Department policy and for a lot of what we recognize as American foreign policy, we did not hear them coming up to Capitol Hill to support a whistleblower to say that George W. Bush ever asked for any foreign policy for personal gain, ever conditioned any allocation of congressional aid to a foreign country because of personal, professional, political gain. And remember that George W. Bush also was in the same seat in 2000, between 2000 and 2004, as President Donald Trump has been from 2016 to 2020. President George W. Bush was an incredibly unpopular president. He was the first person in modern history to get into the White House only on the basis of winning the Electoral College and not by winning the popular vote. He won because of a 5-4 decision that was solidified by Sandra Day O'Connor, who had been appointed as a Republican, and by Clarence Thomas, who had been appointed by his own father, George H.W. Bush, in the Supreme Court. And that decision, that 5-4 Bush v. Gore, is still a decision that many constitutionalists think was wrongly decided, in that it substituted the will of the federal judiciary for the state. And if you read the Constitution, it's pretty clear that state Supreme Courts are supposed to be in charge of their own elections. So President George W. Bush came into power in this country with the media against him, against the popular will, in a Democratic election. And yet you never once heard of any State Department employee coming to Capitol Hill to say, you know what, this president has stepped over the line. This president wants to be reelected so much that he is willing to play ball with foreign interests, foreign enemies, Russia, Ukraine, in order to get him to win in 2004. You never once heard that. It didn't happen. For whatever else President George W. Bush was or wasn't, He understood the rules of the game. And according at least to the State Department, he didn't go over them. Now we have a different president, a different presidency, and the same stakes. We have Donald Trump, and he lost not by 500,000 votes in the popular contest, but by close to 3 million. And he's also sitting in the White House by virtue of the Electoral College. And he wants nothing more than to get reelected in 2020, but it's a very different set of facts that is coming in front of this country every single day by drips and drabs. You have career professionals who have devoted themselves to the country's interest, not the interest of a particular political candidate or the person who happens to be occupying the seat in the Oval Office, but the interest of America, writ capital A. That's what's going on right now. So I think that everybody, whether you voted for Donald Trump or not, whether you voted for Hillary Clinton or not, we have to put our own political biases aside. And we have to say, what is the evidence that is coming forward in front of Congress? And you and I, because we are the American people, I think we have to look at this evidence open-mindedly. I think we have to look at this dispassionately. And I think we have to say, well, what is it? What is the agenda for these people? Are they credible or not? Are they believable or not? Just the way judges and juries evaluate evidence every day. And then we have to decide if we believe them. If we believe their stories, that they believe that the messages to Ukraine were very clear. Unless you are willing to create a conference, a press conference, an investigation into corruption that specifically mentions Hunter Biden, no go on the money. No go on the money. Unless we are willing to say that we have to look at those set of facts. And if we believe that those set of facts are true, then there's another very big judgment that we have to levy. We as American citizens. And we have to levy that in the context of deciding who to vote for next November. And that judgment is, does that behavior rise to the level of a high crime or misdemeanor? Does that behavior show that our president was putting his own personal interests in front of the country's? Yes or no? Very simple. Because if we find that that's a high crime or misdemeanor, then this president should not be in office. And if we find that it did not rise to the level of a high crime or misdemeanor, we put our papers back, we put it to the side, and we move on with our lives. But I don't think we should prejudge. 203-333-9422 at 11:30 on the Lisa Wexler Show. We're going to be back in just a moment with You Be the Judge. You Be the Judge, which means I'm going to give you a fact pattern decided by this Supreme Court, 2019, having to do with a very relatable set of facts. And then I'm going to ask you how you would have determined it. And this one went all over the place, I can tell you right now. 203-333-9422. Do we have law and order or no? And welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. Okay, this is only fun if you play along. 203-333-9422, You Be the Judge. Da-da-da-dum. Or is that Dragnet? Anyway, da-da-da-da-dum. 203-333-9422. So here's the game, very simple. I'm going to give you a fact pattern, and you're going to tell me if you were the judge how you would decide the case. This is a case that, here we go with the facts. Ready? So a man is pretty drunk, as observed by police, and he's not in his car. He's actually, believe it or not, walking away from a car by a lake, and he was arrested. He was arrested for operating a vehicle while intoxicated. And he was, because I know about all this, but I want to find the exact facts about what happened. Here we go. In May 2013, Wisconsin police received a report that a Mr. M, seemingly intoxicated, had driven away from his apartment building. A police officer later found M walking near a lake, slurring his speech and walking with difficulty. His van was parked nearby. The officer administered a preliminary breath test, which revealed an intoxication of 0.24%, significantly higher than what you're supposed to have to be sober. So the officer arrested M for operating a vehicle while intoxicated. Now, remember, he wasn't behind the wheel of his car, but the officer made a presumption that he had been driving while intoxicated, and he arrested him. Once at the police station, the officer placed M in a holding cell, where M began either to drift into either sleep or unconsciousness. Either way, he couldn't be woken up. And at that time, the police said, you know what? The breath test isn't good enough. We want a blood test. We want definitive proof that this guy is drunk as a skunk. So the police officer took M away in a police car to the hospital for a blood test. During the ride, M became fully unconscious. And at the hospital, the officer read M a notice, which gave him the opportunity to refuse the blood testing, but he was unconscious. He was too incapacitated to respond. The officer then said, well, he's consented, and asked the hospital to test M's blood. The blood was drawn about 90 minutes after his arrest, and by then the test revealed a blood alcohol content of 0.22%, significantly higher than the legal limit. At no point did the officer attempt to secure a warrant. M was charged with violating two Wisconsin drunk driving laws and then moved to suppress the blood test results. Why? Because he said, you had time to get a warrant. You didn't get a warrant. I was incapacitated. We have a Fourth Amendment, which says that you cannot unreasonably search me. And I think taking my blood while I'm unconscious is an unreasonable search and seizure and unconstitutional. So you need to throw out the blood test. The reason I'm telling you about a Wisconsin case is because it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which means in the U.S. Supreme Court, which means the law is now the law of the land. It affects Connecticut, New York, wherever you're listening. So let me ask you something. You be the judge. It's very, very simple facts. Very, very simple question. Very, very simple issue. When a drunk driving suspect is unconscious and cannot take a blood test, can you get a blood test without a warrant? Very simple. What do you think about our Fourth Amendment? 203-333-9422. Should you be able to, if you're a police officer, take blood from someone when they're unconscious, if there's time to have gotten a warrant? What do you think? I will tell you that there are a lot of different ways the court looked at this. Some people in the court looked at this under what they call the exigent circumstances exception, which is to say when something is an extreme emergency and the police don't have time, that they can do things because of that that they normally can't do. Other judges looked at this strictly in terms of what Wisconsin said it did, which is that they implied that somebody had consent, even though they were unconscious. Wisconsin has an implied consent statute, which basically says if you're unconscious and the police think that you're drunk, you've implied consent because you didn't say no, you've implied yes. And this, you know, this is a bigger picture altogether. You know, we talk a lot about police power in this, on this show and in the newspapers. There's a lot of conversations about what are the lines between police brutality and the proper show of force? When do the police have a duty to retreat? When do the police have a justifiable reason to shoot? How can we walk in the steps of a police officer? We're not there. They're facing circumstances, nonverbal cues. Even though we may see a camera is only one angle. Remember the movie Rashomon? The movie Rashomon, the famous Japanese movie? It shows a murder committed four or five times. Each of it has a different angle. And when you look through a different person's eyes, the same set of facts looks completely different. So what do you think about this? Should the police, this is a U.S. Supreme Court case, should the police have the right to take you to a hospital and take blood out of you if they think that you're drunk without getting a search warrant? 203-333-9422. Let me give you some time to simmer about that and think about it. Because if you don't play, there's no game. It's 1140 203 3339422. And I really want to get into it a little bit with you because I will tell you this. We have 9 Supreme Court justices. This particular case was not decided by a majority. It was decided by a plurality. Only 4 justices agreed with the same conclusion. One was on the side and agreed only in the result, but not in the reasoning. 4 of them disagreed completely. And in those 4, 3 concurred with one opinion and one wrote his own opinion. And to show you how all over the place it was, the plurality of the people that wrote the 4 concurring opinions included Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, Justice Breyer, who's typically liberal, and Justice Kavanaugh. The one who stood out the side who agreed in the conclusion but didn't agree in the reasoning was Judge Justice Thomas. And then you had other people, 3 of them. So you had a very unusual situation for the plurality. And then you had Justice Neil Gorsuch, and he dissented, even though he's very conservative, but he dissented with his own opinion. And the other dissent was written by Sotomayor and Ginsburg and Justice Kagan. So let's go to Franklin. Franklin, you're in your car. Hi, Franklin. Where are you calling from, more or less?
Hello,
what town?
My name is Frank.
Frank. Hi, Frank. Okay, welcome.
Hello.
Hi. So, what do you think?
Well, I think that actually the officer did not proceed properly. So therefore, the officer was had made a mistake. I think the right thing to do is if the person was incoherent and unconscious, they should have called an ambulance service or other, an EMS people, and then question, say, I don't know, maybe he's drunk, maybe he's on drugs, in which case they would have every right to check his blood to find out what the guy's on. And then, I don't think the person... the drunk person, I don't think he could have very much to stand on against that, because they're looking out for his well-being, not specifically for get him on a drunk driving charge.
So, Frank, so you understand that the blood was taken at the hospital, right? In other words, the police officer didn't draw the blood, but the hospital did.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand
you're
that,
saying
I
that
think,
it should be done for... Right. I hear what you're saying. You're saying, there's a medical issue overriding everything, not the criminal, and that the blood could be used to assist him with medical help, but that it should not be used against him in a criminal proceeding. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Additionally, I don't think the police officer should have transported him to the hospital. I think they should have called the paramedics to where the person was.
Okay. I hear you. Yeah.
Had the person been on other substances and something happened, he very well could have died. And then that would be the police officer's fault.
You know what, Franklin? A lot of the opinion, in the majority opinion, did go towards, in this plurality, because the judges were all over the place, a lot of this did go to the emergency nature of what was happening. But some of the justices kept saying there was no emergency nature for purposes of criminality because the police officer admitted that between the time he had him at the police station where he administered the breathalyzer test and the time that he took to get him to the hospital, that there was plenty of time to have gotten a search warrant if he had wanted to, and that he did not imply his consent. So basically, this really turned... Franklin, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Thank you for the call. 203-333-9422. We're playing You Be the Judge at 203-333-9422. And really the question is, and this is a question that will now determine federal policy, is the question of when a police officer does admittedly have time for a warrant, the question is, at least in their admitted facts, do they have to really get one? Or can they take an unconscious person to a hospital and draw blood and use that blood in a criminal proceeding as evidence of someone's intoxication without their consent? And is there, in fact, consent implied by being in the custody of the police because you are unconscious and perhaps drunk? Let's go to Mark. Hi, Mark. Where are you calling from? Hello.
I'm down on Fairfield.
Hi, Mark. Okay, welcome to the show today. What do you think about this set of facts?
Well, the officer didn't have any visual of operations, so that's the first issue. He found the gentleman walking around. For all we know, he could have been drinking after he drove to increase his blood alcohol. He brought him to the breathalyzer. The guy was semi-conscious because there could have been a diabetic issue. Something you should look into as far as medical needs.
Good question. Don't know.
And then he drove him to the hospital, which your other caller mentioned, which is a huge liability issue. And then the guy was passed out, and the implied consent was passed out. So my question would be, and this might start a whole new firestorm, would be, if Wisconsin says if you're passed out, your implied consent is yes, does that mean if you give a tainted drink to a female and take advantage of her, somebody's going to turn around and say, well, the implied consent is yes, that she was passed out? It opens up a whole other...
Well, that's a different yes. Consent. Mark, are you talking about a sexual yes, or are you talking about a consent to criminal to liability for criminal testing? We're talking about completely different yeses here. Totally.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what Wisconsin's law is on the implied consent. That's all I'm saying.
Well, they were specifically talking about...
Yes.
Yeah, they were talking about implied consent specifically to undergoing this kind of a procedure.
As far as taking the blood for a medical need, yeah, there's an implied consent. You got to find out, make sure the guy isn't having a medical issue. Then he can go get a warrant after they find out, you know, the proper procedure would be go get a warrant.
You know what?
Plain and simple in the Fourth Amendment.
What I think was really interesting, Mark, was when you first hit upon, which is he was walking. I saw that too, and I thought, gee, that raises a question to me as to what kind of presumption is a police officer making about that. But it's because there was a call. I think, first of all, it wasn't raised in the Supreme Court case. By the time it gets to the Supreme Court, they usually only take it on one narrow question. But it does raise the question about the probable cause of the police officer to begin with to assume that he was driving. But I think it's because the police had gotten a call from a neighbor that there was a drunk driver in the neighborhood. So that's probably why he made the arrest.
Wouldn't you want a statement that say that this person saw them actually physically driving the vehicle?
You would want that, yes. And again, the facts don't disclose it one way or another. It wasn't challenged.
Right.
But thank you for the call.
I don't know how the Supreme Court... Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the call. Okay, so we've had Mark and Frank weigh in. When we return, I'll tell you how the judges decided the case. The case of the blood alcohol unconscious person. When we return on the Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600. Stay tuned. This has been a fast show. Thanks to all of you who made it so great with all your phone calls today. Love it, love it, love it. Don't you love that it's just been the two of us today? I think we've had a great time. Passed in a minute and a half. It's 8 minutes before the hour, 203-333-9422. All right, if you're just joining us now, let me give you a recap. A man named M was arrested for operating a vehicle while intoxicated. He was taken to a nearby hospital for a blood test. He was found unconscious, but his blood was drawn under a state law in Wisconsin that presumes that a person incapable of withdrawing implied consent has not done so. In other words, because he couldn't say no, he said yes. And charged with violating drunk driving laws, M moved to suppress the blood test results. The Wisconsin Supreme Court said the blood test results were good, and that decision was appealed. And the basis of the appeal was the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which, as a general rule, says that the state is not able to unreasonably search or seize. And that rule against unreasonable searches and seizures has been the bulwark of a lot of privacy decisions in the criminal law. So let me give you a little bit of history. Many, many years ago, the Supreme Court decided a famous case, the Schmerzler case, the Schmerzler case or the Schmerber case, something like that. I'll give you the exact case. Schmerber, S-C-H-M-E-R-B-E-R. And Schmerber, many, many years ago, said that generally speaking, the general rule is that the state can't take your blood. The state can't take your blood. That by its nature is an unreasonable search or seizure. But with every rule, there's an exception. And the exception, which was in the Schmerber case, said that sometimes the state can take your blood. The state can take your blood when the law calls it an exigent circumstance, E-X-I-G-E-N-T, meaning something urgent and emergency, exigent. And specifically, Schmerber says that there's an exigent circumstance when the blood alcohol evidence is dissipating, which it usually is, right, in the immediate aftermath of somebody being arrested for drunk driving, and some other factor creates a pressing health, safety, or law enforcement need that would take priority over a warrant application. Because both conditions are met when a drunk driving suspect is unconscious, according to the dissent Schmerber controlled. So the three dissenters, Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and who was the third one? Oh, and Justice Ginsburg, they felt that this was a very clear case. They felt that there was no implied consent whatsoever, and that Schmerber controlled, meaning that there was no exigent circumstance because Wisconsin had admitted that they had time to take a warrant for the blood and they hadn't done so. But that was not what the ruling was. The ruling was by the four justices, which included Justice Stephen Breyer, Alito, our new Justice Kavanaugh, and the Chief Justice Roberts. They said that there were exigent circumstances anyway, that despite the fact that Wisconsin had pled that there weren't, they decided that they would go in and retry the facts. That's why this case was all over the place. The Supreme Court justices said, you're not supposed to do that. You're not even doing Supreme Court justice law the right way. And the bottom line is that they upheld it. And they said that in these circumstances, the police officer was entitled to get this guy to a hospital. And while he was unconscious, to take his blood and use the blood alcohol content from that blood test against him in a criminal proceeding. While he was unconscious, even though they'd had time to get a warrant and chose not to do so. And the reason I'm telling you that this is majority, I mean plurality, not majority, is because whenever you have four justices agree on something and agree on reasoning on something, it isn't nearly as strong as when you have five. Now, the reason that the search was upheld was because Justice Thomas disagreed with the reasoning on exigent circumstances, but he liked the conclusion. He would have upheld the search warrant on different grounds. So he says, because I would have upheld it on different grounds, I concur in your conclusion. But four out of the nine justices disagreed in the conclusion and the reasoning, including Justice Neil Gorsuch, who stood by himself with his own opinion of why this whole thing didn't make any sense. But that was the decision. So the cautionary tale is, number one, don't ever get drunk and drive, right? We know that. But we should say it. It's worth saying again. Don't ever get behind the wheel of a car if you're not completely and totally in your senses. How dare you do so? How dare you do so? Call an Uber. Call a friend. Drink a lot of coffee and water. Do whatever you have to do, but don't get behind the wheel of a car when you're drunk. That's numero uno. And the second is, if you find yourself in that situation and you pass out, it may very well be that you end up in a hospital, not because anybody particularly cares that you passed out, but because the police want to have a really good criminal case against you, and they want to take your blood. I'll post the case a little bit later on the Lisa Wexler Facebook page, so you can see it. In the meantime, there was one other matter that I really had to talk about with you before we go to Friday, before we go to the weekend. This made the Jerusalem Post, of all things. Someone appears to have put dead chickens in a Jewish grave in Connecticut. Did you see this? Melissa reported this morning. Police are investigating whether someone dug up remains and placed dead chickens in a grave at a Jewish cemetery in Hartford. The president of Agudas Achim, the Orthodox congregation that manages the cemetery, said they were told of the incident on Wednesday, according to NBC Connecticut. A grave digger, Tommy Valentin, told NBC that the grave had a hole and was full of water when he found it, and there appeared to be two dead chickens floating in it. Police are investigating the incident and it appears someone dug it up by hand several days ago. Can we talk about that? How gory and creepy and gross that is? Did you ever see that HBO detective story thing with Matthew McConaughey? They were investigating that creepy cult in Texas. That was a creepy series anyway. That's what it looks like here. It looks like some satanic cult creepy thing, digging up grave remains and putting chickens in instead. And on that night note, on that good news feeling, I will tell you that Paul Pacelli is already in the studio. He's going to be with you from 2 to 6, so don't miss it. Clark Howard up next. I'm Lisa Wexler. Thank you for joining us today, and I'll be back behind the mic on Monday. Have a wonderful weekend.